This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello there, and welcome to the Jod Bite. I'm Alex Clark, and today I'm interviewing Minnie Mao, who's joined us at JBCA. So hi, Minnie.
Hi, Minnie.
Hi.
Hi, Alex.
So who are you? Why are you here? Tell us.
So my name's Minnie, and I have recently started here at the University of Manchester as a Marie Curie Fellow in Anna Scaife's group. But I'm actually based out at Jodrell Bank Observatory because it's really pretty down there.
Cool. So you've joined us in the last few months, right? You're relatively
right. So I started here at the beginning of May, and so mm-hmm. I've been here for, I guess, 6 weeks now, trying to understand the British accent.
Are you enjoying it?
Very much so. Yeah. I was a little bit nervous coming into this country because I knew it was a very busy country. I moved over from the Netherlands. My previous job was at Jive, and I lived in a little town called Ley that's so small that all the streets are called Ley.
Right.
And there were like 250 people. So I was trying to find a similarly small town to live in near Jodrell Bank. And the closest town was Goostrey, but it had 2,500 people. So I was a little concerned, but it turns out to be a really nice little town.
It's very nice.
And the wildlife here is stunning. Yesterday on my bike ride home, I saw one pheasant, four squirrels, and three bunnies.
Fabulous. Great stuff. So you just mentioned that you were at Jive previously in the Netherlands.
Right.
Do you, if we backtrack even more, where have you been?
Right. So I did my PhD at the University of Tasmania, which is the big island of Australia, and finished at the end of 2012 when I moved over to NRAO Socorro. So I lived in Socorro for 3 years, just under 3 years, and then moved to the Netherlands. So my mum always jokes that, you know, if you plot the kind of population density and where I live, really right now I should be living in a town of about one. Because I went from Melbourne, Hobart, Socorro, Ley, and Goostrey. So I've come up. There's an upturn in there.
Very nice.
So, yeah.
Cool. So what do you study? What are you researching? Is the next question.
Oh, I'm really proud of the title of my project. Anna actually came up with this. My project is called Here Be Spiral Dragons. So it's a play on Here Be Dragons because we're searching the unknown. But the sources that I'm studying are actually called spiral dragons, which is basically a spiral galaxy that hosts a dragon.
A literal dragon.
Charmander. No, so Dragon is an acronym actually coined by Paddy Leahy, who's here in the department, and I'm sure you guys all know Paddy.
Yeah.
That was one of the reasons I wanted to come here. I was really excited about meeting Paddy and working with Paddy. So Dragon is ostensibly an acronym for double radio source associated with galactic nucleus. And I'm quoting Paddy's website here, however, this expansion in no way constitutes a definition. Basically, to me, a dragon is anything that's kind of over a few tens of kiloparsecs and has the classic double-lobed radio structure that we're used to seeing associated with, you know, supermassive active black holes. So these things in themselves are interesting, but I'm looking at dragons that are hosted by spiral galaxies. And this is particularly exciting because empirically, so observationally, dragons have only ever been seen to be hosted by elliptical galaxies. And this makes sense. To be fair, we don't have a very good understanding of how dragons are triggered or radio jets are triggered, but leading galaxy formation models suggest you need to have a major merger, kind of pump heaps and heaps of stuff onto the black hole, turns it on, blasts out these, you know, fairly large, you know, billions and billions of kilometers long radio jets and lobes. And of course, if you have a major merger, you're going to disrupt any spiral structure. So at least following conventional galaxy formation models, it's pretty well impossible to have a spiral galaxy hosting a dragon, a double-lobe radio structure. Mm-hmm. And I think in 1998, Michael Ledlow was the first person to discover a spiral galaxy, 0313-192, phone number, that hosted a 300 kiloparsec radio source. And this is phenomenal. I've actually got a lot of data right now with very long baseline interferometry to figure out if it's a chance alignment. Yeah, so these things, basically spiral dragons cannot host double-lobe radio sources following leading galaxy formation theories, and yet we see them. And right. I'm actually really excited about the source that we found last year, 2 years ago now, I had a summer student looking for more of these things. So at the time, there were only, I think, two or three examples, and none of them are really good examples. And so my student got data from Galaxy Zoo, which is a citizen scientist project where citizen scientists morphologically classify galaxies, and took a sample of spiral galaxies and cross-matched it with archival radio data. And we found one spiral dragon. And this thing is a spiral galaxy. So this is the first time that we've gone from the optical direction. We found the spiral galaxy. It's got these, in this case, 90 kiloparsec radio lobes, beautiful structure. But this is the first face-on spiral galaxy that hosts a dragon. And this is the best example we have yet of a so-called grand design spiral, you know, very clear host, very beautiful arms. Mm-hmm. And the Galaxy Zoo citizen scientists agree, I think it's like 98% or 96% of the citizen scientists agree that it's spiral and on its clockwise, anti-clockwise structure. So that was really cool. And I'm really proud because it was a summer student that really made that discovery. Nice. So that was really neat. Nice. I'm talking too much, sorry.
No, it's great. It's very interesting. So it's really quite a novel project.
We think so. So basically what I mean, short stories, I don't know how these things are formed. We have some ideas. All of them seem to be in kind of denser than field environments, but not super clusters. Like they're kind of in poor clusters or rich groups. So we're wondering whether it could be to do with the density of the, you know, intergalactic medium. And right now what I'm focused on looking at is a lot of VLBI, very long baseline interferometry data, to see if there's something special with the black hole, basically. And the other thing is spiral galaxies tend to have a lot more gas than elliptical galaxies, so it'd be really interesting to see if the jets actually interact with the gas in the host galaxy. Yeah.
Cool. So you mentioned students, and that brings us on nicely to something you've been running here.
A group of us in Anna's group just finished running the inaugural RABID school. It's the radio astronomy boot camp I did. You have to imagine it in Yoda's voice. Right. But basically, the term time has finished for the University of Manchester students, and we're really lucky to have a number of these excited undergrads working with us as summer students over the course of 6 weeks throughout the summer break. They're all starting at vaguely different times, and when speaking with the other supervisors, we realized that we're all going to have to teach them from scratch a lot of the things, because their radio astronomy course doesn't start until, I think, about fourth year. And so we had this idea of running a boot camp to over 2 days and kind of just giving them a taster, showing them what Linux looks like, basic programming. We did a Python course that was very well received. That was Justin Bray. We showed them a little bit of Apes and Casa, and we took them out to the telescope, which they really enjoyed. And we also had some public lectures by Professor Tim and Professor Ralph. So it went down really well. So the students really loved going out to site and just connecting with the telescope. So I'm really, really happy with that. Yeah. And I'm excited that my summer student starts.
Yeah, I was at the history talks by Ralph. Yeah, and
they were so cool.
Tim. Yeah, they were really good. Yeah. So the history of Jodrell Bank is really quite astounding.
I haven't found too much online about that. Are there resources, websites, or is Professor Tim kind of working on it?
I'm not actually sure if there's anything official. I mean, so it's, as he was saying, this is a heritage site, it's a grade one listed building, and it's one of the only sort of scientific structures. But I think there's work in progress, because they're talking about sort of collecting all the thoughts from these older generations who have, you know, who were talking to Lovell and the people back in the 40s and 50s. Who we can't talk to now, but a lot of their sort of phrases and the thing and the stories they have, documenting them is.
Have you been for a walk around the site?
Yeah.
There's so much stuff lying around. It's really interesting. Mm. And did I tell you about our hedgehog detection project?
No, please do.
So, I'm really excited about the UK. I grew up in Australia. But your wildlife here is just insane. You know, kangaroos and possums are pedestrian, but like, you know, squirrels are the coolest things ever, and foxes. And so I've never seen a hedgehog. And a few weeks ago, like the second week that I was in the UK, I signed myself up for a hedgehog detection workshop, because it's a hedgehog detection workshop.
Okay.
And basically we made these little hedgehog detection tunnels, then we can see if hedgehogs have passed through them. And I live in a flat, so I can't very well put one in front of my house.
Yeah.
So we asked the health, Mike Anderson, if we could probably put some hedgehog detection tunnels out on site, and he said yes.
Nice.
So we've been putting some out, and I actually took the students out yesterday to show them. And I said this to Professor Tim, and he's just like, well, I suppose that's okay so long as you're not putting, you know, the exact coordinates of things on the internet. And I'm like, oh, that's exactly what I've been doing, so I don't lose exactly where I've put the hedgehog detection tunnels. So I've taken that all offline.
Is it like secret?
There's so much old stuff around, and hedgehogs tend to like kind of piles of stuff to hide in. So my tunnels tend to be where there's lots of stuff. Yeah, so Tim's worried that people will come in and want to see, you know, if I've got coordinates, they'll see all the stuff because I have photos and things like that.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I've made it private, but if you're interested, I'll show you later. I'm really proud of it. We haven't detected any hedgehogs, but we have detected, if not rats, then water voles.
Right.
The footprints look quite similar, but we...
So I was going to say, how do you detect them? By their footprints?
Oh, it's so cool. Yeah, so you have a weatherproofy sort of triangle tunnel.
Yeah.
And then you put food in the middle. We have hedgehog food and cat food. And then you put oil-based ink, so that's not bad for the animals, kind of on some masking tape so it doesn't get absorbed by the thing. Then you have a piece of white paper on the outsides. And the hedgehog will walk over, get his little feet dirty, eat something, and he'll walk away and leave little footprints.
Very nice.
So I just think it is really cool. Yeah, I love the site. The site is so beautiful. There's just so much to see. Every day I go for a little ramble.
There's lots to discover there. Okay, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for talking to us, Minnie.
Thank you for having me.
Very interesting. And I'm sure you'll be joining us again soon on the Jodcast in one form or another.
Hopefully. Yeah. This was fun. Thank you very much, Alex.
Cheers. Thanks very much.